Welcome, everybody. We are holding this class today at a moment where in our respective houses or wherever it is we're Zooming from might feel very peaceful, but there is an attack happening on civilian centers as we speak in Kiev after several days of attacks on Kharkov's citizens. And I feel it would be remiss of us not to start our meeting today with prayer. So I will read out loud the following chapter, from Psalms. It's a chapter that is often read when people pray for peace amongst individuals, but there's something appropriate about it also for for nations and for the world itself. So I will read it out loud in the Hebrew. Mizmor shiru la'Adonai shir chadash. כי נפלאות עשה, הושיע לו ימינו וזרוע קודשו. הודיע אדוני ישועתו לעיני הגויים גילת צדקתו. זכר חסדו ואמונתו לבית ישראל, ראו כל אפסי ארץ את ישועת אלוהינו. הריעו לאדוני כל הארץ, פצחו ורננו וזמרו. זמרו לאדוני בכינור, בכינור וכל זמרה. בחצוצרות וכל שופר, הריעו לפני המלך אדוני. ירעם הים ומלואו, תבל וישבי בה. נערות ימחו כף, יחד הרים ירננו. לפני אדוני כי בא לשפוט הארץ, ישפוט תבל בצדק, ועמים במישרים. We are glorifying God and saying how the whole world is glorifying him because he has come to judge the world in justice. And we pray that may God judge the world in justice now, and that the God who showed his hand in history and saved us from our oppressors will be present for all of humanity right now. That is my prayer, and I hope you will join me for it. And now, with that in mind, let us go and see how God extended his deliverance to us when we were oppressed in the land of Egypt. In the previous two classes, we really just touched, in a sense, the introduction to the Exodus itself. We touched a little bit upon the, how the oppression came to be. We touched upon the birth and then the early life of Moses and the way in which his very birth and then later his actions foreshadow or give us keys to understand what the deliverance of the Jews will require. When I say Jews, I mean Israelites in this context. I'm just using it interchangeably, even though in the text, they're never described as Jews at that point. They're Israelites, B'nai Israel, sons of Israel. And we saw that we already could see just from all the different experiences Moses went through, as we discussed in the previous class, that liberty is going to be a broader journey than just a journey to shake off the Egyptian shackles from our arms. We saw that there's going to be the process of having to find speech, just like Moses has to find his voice and be able to speak up. The Jews, who at the beginning only groan under the effort, will have to find a way to speak and indicate their identity, indicate what they want. We saw in Moses that there's he's going to need to be able to work with other people to achieve the liberation. He's going to need Aaron, his brother. In a similar way, we will see that the Jews will need each other to achieve liberation. And in a sense, in the same vein of trying to understand what exactly is included in the book of Exodus's concept of liberty, today we're going to see how even when God himself steps onto the world stage and starts acting to actively liberate the Jews from oppression, he is trying to achieve more than physical liberty. What we're going to look at today are the first nine plagues. The plagues are extraordinary. They're extraordinary, first of all, because they're miraculous. And they're big public miracles that, in a sense, look almost like magic. In fact, according to many of the commentators, the first few plagues didn't impress Pharaoh so much because he thought, oh, it's just another variation on the same magic powers that my wise men develop and work and cultivate. So that's one extraordinary aspect of them. But the other extraordinary thing is that God, who is the creator of the world and somehow above us, above human events, above human weaknesses, above human conditions, and God, who until this moment we only saw really interacting with humanity through these unique individuals who are somehow worthy of his notice, is stepping onto the stage like a general, like a king, saying, these people who you think are under your control, Pharaoh, I'm going to take them and they're going to be mine now. Much like kings in the ancient world waged wars. It's an interesting fact. Many of the ancient world's wars were not war of conquest of land. They were war of conquest of people. And we will touch upon it in a bit to understand why that was the case. Why many of the most ancient civilizations, when they set out to war, were not so much interested in keeping the land, but rather in enslaving the population that they beat and taking it back home with them. And this will come into play very soon. When God steps into the stage like this, for us, theologically, from a perspective of faith, he, capital H, raises a very important question. Why does he need to do it in this way? Why do we need to have 10 long plagues? And today we're not even going to cover all of them. I'm just going to cover the first 9. Why does God need to stretch it out to give a plague, make the Egyptians suffer, give Pharaoh an opportunity to say, okay, fine, I'll let the Jews go, then give Pharaoh the opportunity, or sometimes cause him by hardening his heart to go back on his word, and then go on with another plague? The key to that is in the way God himself presents the plagues. And here I will open our source sheet for those of you who have it printed out. It's in box number 1. Just so I can make it a little bigger. And I will read God's declaration of war, so to speak, in Exodus 7. God replied to Moses, "See, I place you in the role of God to Pharaoh, with your brother Aaron as your prophet." In other words, you're my emissary. An emissary, the messenger of a person, represents him, embodies him when he talks to other people. Moshe embodies, in a sense, in a formal sense, not in a physical sense, obviously, God. "You shall repeat all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh to let the Israelites depart from his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart." Here, God is already moving the curtain a little bit, so to speak, letting us look backstage, letting us look at his intentions, at what he means for this event to be. "That," or in Hebrew, "so that I may multiply my signs and marvels in the land of Egypt." In other words, the plethora of plagues that's about to swarm over the land of Egypt and bring it to its knees is not a matter of chance. It's not a matter of, oh, God couldn't convince Pharaoh otherwise. That's the design all along. "When Pharaoh does not heed you, I will lay my hand upon Egypt and deliver my ranks, my armies, my people, the Israelites, from the land of Egypt with extraordinary chastisements." In Hebrew, shvatim gdolim, gdolim as in large, larger than life. "And the Egyptians shall know that I am God when I stretch out my hand over Egypt and bring out the Israelites from their midst." If we read it just on the level of pshat, of the simple meaning of these words, the meaning, the goal of God seems to be not merely to take the Israelites out of Egypt. It is to make the Egyptians acknowledge him as God. But the truth is that to understand the full weight of what God says here, we have to take a step back and try and understand what freedom requires at this point in history. We all know that physical freedom frees us to go elsewhere, frees us to do things we couldn't do before, but it can't change our horizons of expectations in and of itself. For example, when we look at these Egyptian slaves, the Jews, let's pretend that God will snap his fingers And the gates of Egypt, so to speak, will open up and they'll be allowed to go. They're not going to immigrate to America and the New World, right? They have no conception of the existence of another continent elsewhere. They're not going to suddenly decide, let's start a democracy. They have no concept of anything like that. In other words, even though I know I'm being a little bit ridiculous, like I'm creating ridiculous alternatives, but the point I'm trying to make is that even though they are now might be free to go, the options that they might pursue are still limited by their experience. Whatever it is they know of the world limits what they can imagine as the next step. It's a limitation on the imagination and therefore on the action. And if God would have just snapped his fingers, and let's say he would have forced the knowledge of his godhood onto the Egyptians in some magical way on the way just to get that goal out of the way, what would the Israelites then do with their experiences, their expectation, their world as they know it, entirely bound out in the Egyptian way of life? Naturally, and we see it in history over and over again, what a group like that would do is go and found their own Egypt, their own Egypt-like world with Paro and a new Paro enslaving the people, with everybody being in the strict hierarchy where the king is above all and everybody to some extent is enslaved to the god, to the men at the top, and might makes right. This was the world they knew. But in the story of the plagues, God is doing more than just opening the gates of Egypt for them. God is trying to pry open their horizons of expectation. God is trying to offer them a glimpse into the possibility of having a society that's built on a different premise, on different lines, on a different structure than the Egypt that they are leaving now. God is trying, in a sense, to free them, not just from Egypt, the place, but from Egypt, the conception, Egypt, the world order as it exists. We will see it when we start diving into the Makot themselves, into the plagues. But in order to see it, and forgive me for going on and on and on with this introduction, but it's important for understanding what's to come. I want to talk for a moment about what it is that they need to leave behind. What is this world that we will watch God prying open and breaking into pieces so as to free the Israelites' minds from the scheme of things that is the Egyptian way of life? Excuse me for a second. But to understand this world, we need to imagine for a second that we don't know much of what we know. We need to imagine ourselves or put ourselves in the feet of people who live in a very agrarian world where the number one concern, in a way that for most of us who are fortunate to live in the first world, is not an urgent concern in the same way. The urgent concern is subsistence. How will you get food? How will you feed yourself? How will you feed your children? How will you feed your children enough to bring them healthy into adulthood? In fact, it was such a difficult assignment that many people failed. We have archaeological remains from Egypt, and we have skeletal remains from Egypt. And I'm not talking now about the tombs of the kings with all their glory. I'm talking about the simple people and the level of starvation, the level of skeletons that show very severe nutritional deprivation is unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. The life expectancy was low. Child mortality was high. Diseases came all the time, especially in areas that were more civilized, where people lived closely together, especially by rivers that have that bring about a source of life for people, but also bring about a very unhealthy climate in terms of the spread of disease. And people just didn't have the stamina. People didn't have the nutritional stamina on a very simple level. We're talking the bottom of Maslow's pyramid of needs here. They didn't have the stamina to survive. So in this world where concern number one is food, there was this story that the big kingdoms told themselves about themselves. And the story was, I will take upon myself to voice it as if I am a kingdom. I am Egypt, or I am Babel, or I am Nineveh, or Ur, or any of those old ancient civilization of Mesopotamia and the Nile. The story goes something like this. People cannot survive if they don't come together in large enough numbers to produce enough food and defend it from other people who might form bandit bands, I don't know how you call it, troops of bandits, and come and raid them. People simply cannot survive otherwise. They need to live close together so they can protect each other, so that they have enough hands to work the land, which is a long and filled with drudgery process that requires physical strength and many people to involve to raise enough grain to feed the population. And in order to be protected, you need an army. In order to have an army, you need a king who controls the army. In order to have a king and an army, you need taxes. In order to have taxes, you need to have someone who collects the taxes and gives them to the king so he can pay it to the army. And the whole world becomes defined, as Yoram Chazoni puts it in his book about the philosophy of Hebrew scripture, by the closed circle of king, tax collector, priest, and farmer. Let us see it together in the source sheet. I am here in box number 2. Thus, in the ethics of the ancient Near East, all action was ultimately directed towards the maintenance of the state, since all goodness was seen as flowing from it. Indeed, whatever served to maintain the close circle of farmer, tax collector, king, soldier, and priest was on its face for the good, since it kept the clockwork of the state in motion for another day and another generation, maintaining the mass of people alive and protected. What we see very beautifully done in Yoram Chazoni's quote here is that the story that a civilization tells about itself, the story that we need all of this, the king, the soldier, the tax collector, to survive, shapes our ethics. It's no longer just an ontological or political science statement about how the world should run in order for us to survive. It becomes a justification or a limitation on what's moral and what's not moral. Because if something might threaten this closed circle, if something might destabilize the king, and thus perhaps destabilize the army, and thus perhaps make us vulnerable to bandits coming to kill us and take our food, then it's immoral. Whereas anything that the king does to strengthen his power, the power that is seen as the linchpin of the system that allows people to have food, anything that helps the king maintain this power becomes ethical. For example, enslaving a whole population becomes ethical in people's minds, something that they can accept and live with. Throwing babies in the river becomes something ethical and acceptable that people participate in, because the good of the state becomes this disproportionate definition or arbiter of what's good and what's bad. In many cultures, in many of the ancient civilization cultures, I mean, this kind of self-perception and its ethical ramification became rooted also in theological terms that glorified the kings as gods. And nowhere was it more consistent and played out to great effect in temples and archaeological sites of various kinds and displays of wealth that we still find digging back under the sands of Egypt. Nowhere was it as specifically, clear as and explicit as it was in Egypt itself. I'm going to read here the next paragraph in the source sheet. It's by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks from his book, Ceremony and Celebration, about the holidays. It is worth reflecting more fully on who Ramses was. Ramses III is widely believed to be the king who is our Paro, the Paro from our story, and what he represented. No one in history constructed more monuments to his glory than Ramses II. It is clear that when Paro responds angrily to Moses' request in God's name to let the Israelites go, saying, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let the Israelites go? I do not know the Lord. What he means is, here, I am God. Meaning, here in Egypt, this Lord of yours is no saint. I am God. But, as Rabbi Sacks points out in the next sentence, this godhood of the king who supplies for the people and keeps the kingdom and therefore the food supply intact, didn't actually bring such great prosperity all around. The wealth of the royal court, goes on Rabbi Sacks, was astonishing. At the same time, the population as a whole lived a wretched experience. As I said, those archaeological remains from Egypt find people who are constantly on the edge of starvation, while a little distance away, the tombs of the kings are filled with gold and gem and every form of treasure possible. Of course, this world defined by that circle of the king and the grain and the priest and the tax collector and the soldier and the farmer, not only does it have ethical ramifications, not only does it come hand in hand with a certain religious perspective that glorifies the king as, by definition, right, because he is a god of this world, and everything he says is by definition right because it serves the strength of this world. It's also, at its core, based on a lie. This entire perception is based on a lie. And here I am not going into theology to argue that. I'm not making this point from the perspective of the rabbi saying the Torah said this is the wrong system and therefore we should just assume that it's false. No, I am going into from the perspective of the science that looks into archaeological remains of agriculture and says, wait a minute, the whole paradigm of ancient civilizations was wrong. And here, the greatest source I know about it, or I'm sure there's others, but one of the best sources that really collects a lot of what we know today about ancient civilizations and puts it out very clearly, is James C. Scott's book, Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States. And James Scott makes a very interesting discovery. He says that while countries, states, civilizations like ancient Egypt tell themselves that they make life possible on a large scale by creating this collection of grain, the truth is that dense civilizations filled with people grew 4,000 years before these states rose. And those dense populations that grew 4,000 years before the ancient states started rising out of that mists of time, if you want to call it that, those populations were more free because they didn't have a centralized government collecting their food and telling them what to do, and much more able to survive even things like famines, vicissitudes of time, the ice ages of the world, when for 100 years out of the blue, the world becomes much colder all of a sudden. Why? Because they relied for sustenance on a much broader array of foods. They did some planting, some foraging, some hunting, a lot of sweetening, slash and burn methods of gaining food. This is not really a class about ancient agriculture, so I'm not going to go into all of these details here. But what happened, what changed when the state started rising, is that the state forced people to drop all those forms of feeding themselves and instead grow crops that are harder to grow, that take much more work and more people to grow, but are, one, seasonal, and therefore it's easy to tax them. Imagine trying to tax food that people forage from different places at all times. A seasonal food that you know when it's going to be in the granary and your soldiers can go and collect it is much easier to tax. And not only are they seasonal, accumulated because they can stay edible for a long time. They're not the kind of food that people collect from the field and then if they don't eat it, it goes bad. It's a kind of food that if people grow it, and here we're talking about the grain, we're talking about the big five types of grain, wheat, barley, etc., the king can send his people to collect. But as those states rose, and through their legal codes, which we actually have and can look at and see it written in them, forced people through punishment and through various incitement and incentives to grow only grain or mainly grain. As they grew and became stronger, they also had to work fairly hard to force people to grow a surplus. And therefore, they became more and more oppressive and more dictatorial, and invested more and had to collect more grain to support a stronger army to force people to grow more grain. I recently watched this delightful movie, Bug's Life, with my kids, which I've watched as a child, but watching it now as an adult was very striking. I don't know if you're familiar with it. The story of Bug's Life is that there's this cute little colony of ants, and the grasshoppers force them to collect food also for them. And they force it by threats, by threatening to kill the much smaller, weaker ants if they don't collect it for them. But what we see through the movie is how much effort the grasshoppers have to extend to maintain this fear. Because at the end of the day, there's more ants than grasshoppers. So if these ants will stand up, which in the movie they, of course, since it's a American movie, standing up for freedom and individualism and standing up to oppressors, of course, the ants stand up and win in the end. But the oppressors have to invest a lot into maintaining the fear of the population so that the population wouldn't rise. And it may be a children's story, and in real life, we don't deal with grasshoppers as oppressors. I mean, not me, at any rate. That has not been my experience. But it actually captures the dynamic that James Scott describes extremely well. I'm actually going to skip to the second quote here in box number 3. A peasantry, assuming that it has enough to meet its basic needs, will not automatically produce a surplus that elites might appropriate, but must be compelled to produce it. Under the demographic conditions of early state formation, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to the part in bold, only through one form or another of unfree, coerced labor, corvée labor, forced delivery of grain and other products, debt bondage, serfdom, communal bondage and tribute, and various forms of slavery, was a surplus brought into being. Each of the earliest states deployed its own unique mix of coerced labor, as we shall see, but it required a delicate balance between maximizing the state surplus on the one hand and the risk of provoking the mass flight of subjects on the other, especially where there was an open frontier. In the case of the earliest states, making the lower classes reliably unfree meant holding them in the grain corps and preventing them from fleeing. To avoid drudgery and or bondage itself. Do what it might to discourage and punish flight, and the earliest legal codes are filled with such injunctions, the archaic state lacked the means to prevent a certain degree of leakage. Short of stemming the flow, most archaic states sought to replace their losses by various means. And here we're talking about losses of people, of workers, including wars to capture slaves. Hence my point earlier about how the earliest wars were not about land, they were about population. Purchases of slaves from slave takers and forced resettlements of whole communities near the grain corps. When we understand that this was the number one objective of the early state, keeping the people in it to work the land and produce this taxable grain that's trustworthily seasonal, that can be collected and accumulated, And by the way, the Joseph story is a story of a brilliant Jew becoming the instrument to strengthening this experience, this world of that kind of state, collecting the grain and then enslaving the population when they don't have food, and basically sell themselves into slavery in order to have a reliable guarantee that they will be fed. This is exactly a foundational story of this kind of arrangement, of this kind of world order. And we will come back to Joseph's role in it in a bit. So in this world, when we understand that this was the number one concern, how to keep the people in, suddenly Paro's concerns from the beginning of the book of Shmot acquire a different meaning or a different urgency. Let's go and revisit that again. We already read it in our first class, but let's revisit it. This is from Exodus 1, verse 8. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground, from the land." When we read it last time, we focused on his obvious fear that they will join some sort of fight against him. That let's say some other dynasty tries to take over, they will support the other contenders for power and not him. But that expression at the very end, "and rise from the ground," ve'alah min ha'aretz, acquires a slightly different ring, because la'alot min ha'aretz, to go up from Egypt, is to leave Egypt. When Abraham goes to Egypt first, almost loses Sarah there, and then leaves, that's the word that's used to describe him leaving. Ve'alah, he goes up, because Egypt is a flat land, and he's going up to the hills of the land of Israel, of Canaan. So when Paro is expressing two fears, really, the more explicit one is that they will be too many of the Jews, and they will join our enemies, the Egyptians. But the other fear that's implied here in the language is that they will leave altogether, that he will lose this workforce. And suddenly the fact that he's enslaving them extra hard, more than everybody else is already enslaved in Egypt, acquires a whole other layer of meaning, a whole other layer of urgency, sorry, from Paro's perspective. And into this world steps God. And it is this world that God wants to pry open to allow us to see other possibilities, to see that there's different ways of living life. It is this closed circle, as Chazoni calls it, of king, tax collector, farmer, soldier, priest, that God wants to shatter, or at least to pry loose, to let both us and the Egyptians, in a sense, the entire world, glimpse through it and see that, wait a minute, we don't have to live life like that. We don't have to just accept that's the only way to survive. We don't have to accept the ethical ramification, because if this is the only way to survive, then yes, what serves it serves the good and is good, and what hampers it is the bad. But God says, no, no, no. There's universal good and bad. There are things that are just good and things that are bad. And throwing babies in the river is bad, even if it served the strength of the state at this moment. We will get to that. We will get to how exactly God does it. This is what God wants to remove, that illusion that encloses people in that world and makes it impossible for them to imagine that a different world can be possible or can exist. And the way God does it is through several aspects of the plagues, but we will see how each one of these tools that God wields in his war as he lays down the plagues, at the end of the day, what it does is take a tenet or a axiom or a basic experience of this world that Chazoni and Scott describe and challenge it. But before we get into that, I just want to say a word about the structure of the plagues, because we're not going to go one by one. It's not Leila Seder. We're not going to go now over every one of them and see. We're going to talk more in a schematic sense about the type of messages God is sending. But just so we're all on the same page, so we're all refreshed in our mind about what we're talking about, I'm going to go over the first nine plagues very, very fast and just put them in order. The first nine plagues are arranged in sets of three. In each of these sets of three, there's two plagues where God delivers a warning. Moses goes and talks to Paro and gives him a warning of some sort. And Paro is given a chance, basically, to say, fine, go. And then when he doesn't, the plague happens. And then the third one in every set just happens. More than that, though, as we will see in the sets, the first two in every set go together in some sense. It'll be simpler once I say them out loud. The first set includes blood, when all the water in the Nile, and also all the water not in the Nile, in the set, according to some interpretations, turns into blood when the Egyptians drink it. The Jews still have fresh water. And frogs, when some sort of frogs, there's all kinds of commentators that maybe it means little crocodiles, but let's say frogs. Let's stick with traditional meaning of the word in our culture. Frogs rise again out of the Nile and multiply and cover the land, go into people's food and into people's ovens and whatnot, and make life impossible. This is the favorite of my children. They love reenacting that one. So two that go together that have to do with the Nile. And then the third one is lice. Then comes the second set. The first two of that set have to do with animals. The first one is arov. Wild, dangerous animals show up out of nowhere and start attacking people and domesticated animals. The second one is devil. A disease, a plague, hits the domesticated animals and kills them. And then the third, the closet is shechin. It's a disease of the skin for man and animal. The third set targets the crops. And it targets the crops first through hail that comes and breaks all the crops on the fields, except those crops that are still green and therefore supple and can kind of fall under it and then rise back again. But before the Egyptians have a time for a sigh of relief that the green, younger crops are still okay, comes arbe, the locusts, and eat everything up. And the third one of that set is darkness. So now that we have them in some sort of arrangement, Nile and lice, animals and skin disease, crops and darkness, let's ask ourselves schematically, looking through all of that, how God targets the system. I want to pause for a second because I can see that there's this very lively political discussion going on in the chat. I'm not reading the comments as we go, but I want to say that I'm glad for it because I think that the experience of the Exodus is not meant to be read just as a history story about something that happened. It's meant to be read as a message for all times. It's meant to be read as we should all always question whatever system we're part of and say, how can it be freer? That said, I do want to say, and I don't know if it needs to be said, like I said, I didn't have time to read all the comments as they come, but I do want to say that I don't think we can compare our world and our kind of civilization to the peril of the Exodus. I think that we would find that most kings today don't throw babies into rivers. So just to put it a little bit in perspective, we have come a long way. But let's leave that discussion for later. Moving straight on, I want to talk about three ways in which God targets the system itself and tries to pry it loose. The first one is the targets. What are the things that God breaks, that God takes away? The thing that God's take away, or the things that God's targets specifically in the plagues are exactly those things that the ancient kingdoms, the ancient states, told themselves and their subjects are what they guarantee. What the ancient civilization said is, yeah, it's tough to be a slave or enslaved without being called a slave. It's tough to live where you have to give a lot of your food as taxes. It's tough, but we guarantee you'll have some food, some water, some livelihood. God comes and says, really? You say that the Nile gives life. Now let's turn the Nile into blood. In other words, let's make the Nile show its true color because you turned the Nile into a butchering ground for Jewish babies. Let's show it. Let's let it show what it truly is, what you made it. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his discussion, not of this moment, but of the moment of Joseph and Paro's dream, the other Paro, the Paro who dreamed about the cows rising out of the river, said that the significance of the Nile, the reason that Paro, the older, the good Paro, dreamed of things coming out of the Nile, is that the Nile was seen as the source of Egyptian civilization. I'd like to read that quote. It's a beautiful quote. And he says the following thing. He says that when, I'll just read it, actually. I'm in box number 5. From the river, the source of civilization, abundance, and prosperity, emerge beautiful creatures and also the ugly cows. The blessings of the human civilizing experience may be completed by the demonic forces which man, the genius, sets free. Some philosophers have questions whether the dream is worthwhile. Perhaps it would be more beneficial to men to be inactive rather than accelerate the process. What he's talking about here, and I realize that the quote is a little bit shortened and it's difficult to understand, but he's saying that the same source of observation that brings forth prosperity does it by encouraging behaviors or like through human behaviors that are very negative, like enslaving other people, like pollution, like ruining the nature around us to make it produce more for us, like ruining other people to make them produce more for us. Perhaps it would be more beneficial to men to be inactive rather than accelerate the process. Paro was troubled in the morning, but his advisors didn't comprehend his dilemma. They did not grasp that the dream cast doubt upon the whole civilizing process or enterprise. Rabbi Soloveitchik goes on to say that Joseph is trying to offer a way to develop the civilization while being benevolent to other people, while sharing its riches with other people. But I would argue that the end of Joseph's project, which is the enslaving of Egypt that later on spilled into an enslavement of the Jews after his time, shows us that it's harder than we think to develop and grow without corruption coming at the heels of our project. It's a difficult thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to do.
Hello?
Yes? Sorry? Okay.
Oh, sorry.
And in a sense, what God says in the blood and in the frog, and by bringing the blood and the frogs from the Nile, is you, Egypt, failed. Perhaps it is possible for people to develop civilization without enslaving others, but you, Egypt, failed. There's another aspect to it, which is that according to rabbis, but also according to Egyptian sources, they saw the Nile as a god. So God, by targeting the Nile, is saying, no, I am God. There is no this God. No. I am God, and I am going to target. But this is only one of the targets, right? God doesn't only target the Nile. God also targets grain, that very lifeblood of civilization and of ancient state, the very justification to their existence of this oppressive system is the grain itself. And through the hail and then through the locust, God destroys the grain supply. The other food supply that civilization has is animal products. And God, through the second set, I'm sorry, I skipped ahead. I went from the first to the third. Now I'm jumping back to the second. But through the arov, the dangerous animals that come and eat the domesticated animals. And then through devil, that disease that strikes the animals of the Egyptians, God destroys that food supply too. And the truth is that this may seem very, very cruel, right? It's the food of the Egyptians, and most of the Egyptians probably had no notion of what Paro, to stop Paro from stopping the Jews from leaving. But what God does is forcing the Egyptians, in a sense, more than the Jews, to ask themselves, if the system that we buy into because it supplies us with livelihood can no longer supply us with livelihood, is it even worth defending it? Do we want it? Do we want to be under Paro if Paro can't guarantee us clean water and grain and animal products? If Paro can't help us feed our children, why should we continue to enslave ourselves to him, accept his regime out of fear of starvation? He is bringing the starvation upon us right now. And this aspect of these sanctions, if you want to call it, that God applies to the Egyptians here, leads us to another aspect of his campaign. I said that there's three aspects we'll discuss. One aspect is which targets God chooses or marks and then sets out to attack. And the other one is the timing of the plagues. And in here, I mean it in several ways. First of all, it's the very fact that it's drawn out. God is drawing it out to give the people time to reach these conclusions. If all of these plagues were to come at once, the Egyptians wouldn't have had time to reach any conclusions about anything. They would have just starved and died. And that was it. By drawing it out, God is slowly teasing the Egyptians and the Israelites to think, wait a minute, is this system really good for us? Maybe, maybe not. Oh no, another thing happened. Now it really looks like it's not good for us. So this is the first usage of time. By drawing out the plagues, God is giving people time to work out what it means. But it's not the only aspect. Sorry, I have in mind. The other aspect is that God, in those moments when God sends Moshe to warn Paro and give him a chance to back out in a sense, it's often mentioned that he does it, or specifically in three places, it's mentioned that he did it first thing in the morning. And the question is why? And here there's two actually like very different answers. But both of them show us aspects of this attack. The first one I want to mention is the more traditional one, and I don't have it here as a quote, but it's a very well-known one. Rashi, in his commentary, brings it when Moses goes to speak to Paro for, right before the blood, right before turning the Nile into blood, and he goes early in the morning. Rashi, in the name of the sages in the Midrash, suggests that the idea is to catch Paro in the act. That Paro, since he was supposed to be a god, shouldn't have physical needs, doesn't have to go to the bathroom, in other words. So Paro would go early in the morning to the Nile to take care of his business where nobody can see. Forgive my unpleasant topic of conversation. This perception sees what Moses does, the timing of his attack, as an attack against Paro's claim for godhood. But what I want to focus now is on a different interpretation, and one that the Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, pushes forth in his explanation for Exodus 8:15. We're not going to read the whole thing. We'll have to skip parts, but we'll read some of it. He starts by pointing out that if you look at the plagues, which ones does God warn Paro about and which ones does he not? The ones that he warns Paro about have to do with men, men dying, humans dying. In other words, he warned Paro only of those plagues which entailed the death of people. All this reflects his mercies towards men, just as it is said, nevertheless, if thou warn the wicked of his ways to turn from it, and he turn not from his way, he shall die in his iniquity. But thou hast delivered thy soul. And then he goes on to say, why do some of them get warnings early in the morning? And he says that all the ones that have to do early in the mornings, sorry, also has to do with the fact that those endangered people, and God wants more people than just Paro to hear the warning. He wanted the warning to be given in the sight of all people. When the king went forth to the water, a multitude of people followed him. And when Moses will then forewarn him in their sight, perhaps they might plead with their master to return from his evil way. In case they do not do so, they will deserve punishment. God doesn't want to just implicate the Egyptians without giving them an opportunity to rise up against the men oppressing them as well. And therefore, he uses timing in the strategic way. The other, out of the three things I want to discuss today, so one is the targets, another is the timing. The third one, and it's one that really starts coming into play more in the second set, more pronouncedly in the second set of the plagues, even though it really is there throughout, is that God makes a very clear distinction between the Jews and the Gentiles. Why is this important? I'm not saying it's important because it's, God is discriminating, or, I mean, he is, but the point here, it's not nana banana, you know, like mocking the Egyptians that they suffer and we don't. What it means is that when the Egyptians see it happening and the Jews see it happening, they can say, oh, this is a natural disaster. A lot of these plagues look like natural disasters. They look like things that did happen all the time in the ancient world. But when you look and you see that the same exact plague is only affecting parts of the population, while other people are completely, to a man, to a baby, immune, you can't quite say that anymore. And this is a repeated theme in many of the plagues. You have it here in the source sheet. We don't have time to go over it in the text. You can look later in box 7. All of which together, the targets, the timing, and the clear difference or the surgical precision with which God applies it, works. It works not in the sense that it suddenly makes the people rebel against Paro. And it doesn't work in the sense that Paro changes his mind. But it does work in the sense that people in Egypt are starting to question Paro. They're starting to question whether Paro really serves their interests. And perhaps the most dramatic of these places is here. I am jumping ahead. I'm in the bottom of box 8 in Exodus 10. Paro's courtiers said to him, in Hebrew it says, Avdei Paro, the slaves of Paro, how long shall this one be a snare to us? Let a delegation go to worship their God. Are you not yet aware that Egypt is lost? The reason this is so striking is that not only are they speaking up to Paro, but we already saw how scary it was, even for Paro's loved ones, beloved advisors, to speak up to Paro. At the end of Genesis, when Joseph wants to bury his father, he doesn't dare to speak up to Paro and say, I would like to go and bury my father in the land of Canaan. Instead, he goes and talks to the household of Paro and asks them to ask for him to do. And then Paro grants with his great benevolence the right to fulfill. And he comes up with this whole thing that, oh, my father made me promise, which is true. But the fact that he has to mention it means that he can't just ask for what he wants. No, he has to come up with a whole stratagem. And here come the slave of Paro. That's why I prefer to stick with the Hebrew here, the slaves, not the English translation that says courtiers. The slaves of Paro, the people are under his power. And they're so desperate. And it's so clear to them that Paro's course is destroying their own country, that they go and say, why can't you stop? And this is that moment. This is the moment that God has been working towards, the moment when the Egyptians see that I am God, not just in a theological sense, but in a sense that they realize that there's something in the world that exists outside of their system. Now, we have to stop today's class in a weird place because we are almost at the crescendo of the plagues, but we're not going to go there. We're going to keep that, the entire last plague and everything that comes with it, we're going to keep that for next week. And then we will take everything we discussed today and everything that the book of Exodus gives us and bring it to its glorious conclusion. So it's odd, right? We're stopping at the penultimate moment, a cliffhanger, as AY said in the chat. But I feel that we can't quite leave this moment without making a comment about something else. And since I don't have time to answer questions now, I will stay for 10 minutes after the class and answer some of the questions. I can't do it right now because I do want to finish. For those of you who have to leave in 4 minutes, I do want to reach that point. It's important to me. When you look at the story from the side, take a step back, lean back, look at the story, you might notice that there seems to be a weird incongruity, because God is trying to buy or purchase the freedom of the Jews. And if you want to use the terms we developed today, the freedom of the Jews and the Egyptians from the world order as they know it, by enslaving one man. Because time and time again, God makes Pharaoh's heart heavy or hard so he wouldn't change his mind. And it seems rather odd, right? Doesn't it seem rather odd that in order to break the system, God, in order to bring more liberty into the world, God is creating an enslavement in Pharaoh's heart? But I want to look at it and unpack it a little bit and say the following. Already the commentators, the traditional commentators dealing with it, offer several ways to understand what it means. Maimonides famously says that it's natural consequences. In the first five plagues, Paro hardens his own heart. And then in the next five plagues, God hardens it for him. And it's not even a punishment as much as it is a consequence. When you blind yourself so consistently, you can no longer stop it. You put yourself on that one-track mindset, and that's it, and you're done. You became so enamored of your own mythology that you can no longer let it go. A whole other direction interprets it as God, in fact, didn't harden Pharaoh's heart in the sense that he made him more enslaved, but rather helped him not just break down under the pressure, hardened it in the sense that he gave him the opportunity to make his own decision instead of just break under the pressure. That's another direction, and it requires its own whole class to understand what it means, and we're not going to go there. I want to offer Rabbi Sachs's interpretation. Rabbi Sachs, in a passage that you have in the source sheet at the end, you can look at it later, we don't have time now, points out an interesting thing. He points out that when we talk about making a heart heavy in the context of ancient Egypt, it actually means something very specific, because the ancient Egyptians were obsessed with death. And they had this whole idea that when you reach the afterlife, the God that you meet on the way to the afterlife weighs your heart against a feather. The feather is a symbol of the whole world order, the whole world order and all its attached virtues that the Egyptians believed in. And if your heart is as light as a feather or lighter, you go to the good place. And if your heart is heavy, heavier than the feather, then you go to the Egyptian equivalent of hell. When God and Moses use the metaphor of the heavy heart here, what they're telling us is that the heart of the king of Egypt isn't worthy, even by Egypt's terms. It's so heavy that even by Egypt's terms, this is a king who will not reach the happy place in the afterlife. And Rabbi Sachs goes on to say that why is it so heavy? Because while Paro is trying to defend the world order as he knows it, he's confused about ends and means. He thinks this world order is an end that justifies everything. While our world order, any world order, and that is God's argument that he makes into history and that echoes to our day, any world order is only as just as its adaptation or its reflection of universal values of good and bad, not the strength of the world order or its ability to maintain itself are the arbiter, but rather something that goes beyond it, beyond the circle of farmer and king and tax collector, beyond the feather of the Egyptian world order, beyond how we perceive ourselves. As we watch right now, our world order standing on the line in Ukraine, as we watch demonstrators in Moscow thrown into prison, may the message of the Exodus ring loud and clear for us, for our leaders, and may the maker of the world and the redeemer of men help us to get through this time. And on that note, thank you very much. As I said, I will stay for a few minutes and take some of the questions, but for those of you who have to go, thank you very much, and I'll see you next week, God willing. Maxine, is that okay? Can I take a few extra minutes?
Of course.
Okay, so let me see. I cannot answer all the political questions necessarily, but let's see what I can. Okay. Just a minute. Some of the questions I feel were answered already later in the class, so I'm not going to go back to those. And I apologize if it's your question and you feel like it didn't, you feel free to write to me later. Okay. I see a lot of interesting political comments. Just a minute. Gershon Hefner made an interesting comment here where he said, Potiphar gave Joseph complete freedom except regarding bread. Oh, I lost it. Okay. Ki im halechem levado. He needed Joseph to help him produce the agricultural surplus of grain on which Pharaoh depended. And then, of course, thank you, Gershon. And also, of course, then Joseph goes on to help Pharaoh create the surplus on a much, much, much larger scale. Naomi Bariam notes correctly, and I mean, I'm not a teacher saying correct, not correct. I'm just saying thank you. It's a very good comment. In addition to the Israelites asking questions about the value of Pharaoh and the system, the Egyptians could ask the same things. Exactly. That's exactly the point. Sima Hertzberg pointed out that in some places it says that he hardens Pharaoh's heart, and in some places it says that he strengthened Pharaoh's heart. I recommend if you look in the source sheet, there's a reference to Rabbi Sachs's articles about Parashat Va'era, and he talks about the difference between these roots and why they're interchangeable here, but he also references some commentaries about how they're different. We don't have time to go into it now, but I highly recommend looking up, just Google Rabbi Sachs on Parashat Vayera. He has several very good articles on that topic exactly. Just a moment. As Asher Stein pointed out, Yosef is very powerful. He is the second in command, yet he remains beholden to Pharaoh, even he is not really free. As Yoram Chazoni puts it, even the first among slaves is still a slave. And the best you can aspire for within the system is to be either the paro, and then you have to throw the babies into the river, or the most useful slave paro has, who then enjoys some privileges. Carol Sterling wrote, interesting how the protection to plagues might be related to COVID plague today. Carol, are you still here? I'm not sure what you mean by the protection to plagues. Okay.
Yes, I am here.
Yeah.
So you said that the Israelites were protected and didn't get the plagues. And yet the exact opposite happened today with the plagues. And if we're to take some of these lessons from it, I was just curious how you might look at it today.
I understand. I can't really say. I feel like we're still living through this plague, so it's a little bit hard to analyze it. Your guess is as good as mine. I would say, though, and it's interesting. The experience of plagues as such was very prevalent in the ancient world. And the word we call these the plagues, in Hebrew we call them makot, the hittings, the being beaten up, because plagues actually means a plague like what we live through today. And today's is much better than what the world lived through on a regular basis throughout history. So I'm not even sure that calling it plagues, calling all these things plagues, necessarily serves us very well when we try and analyze it. And you could say natural disasters, in a sense, God-driven, surgically accurate natural disasters. And honestly, your guess is as good as mine. There's a anonymous question here, whether the non-Jewish slaves were impacted by the plagues, were they? It seems so, yes. It seems that everybody in Egypt is considered the slave of Pharaoh. And in that regard, and I mean, having what James Scott speaks about in mind, about how the government has to control the population at all times, it makes sense. Everybody's a slave on some level or another, and it is the slaves who are hurt, which is very painful and feels very unfair, and it is unfair on an individual level. And it's not that different from what we do in the modern world when we put sanctions on a different government. Because I'll give you an example. My aunt lives in Moscow, and right now all her savings are worth nothing. All the money she was counting on living for the rest of her life is worth nothing. And it's a painful thing. She's not pro-war in Ukraine. She's not a supporter of Putin, but she's paying the cost. This is what sanctions are. This is what sanctions are also in the story of the plagues. Is it easy for me to live with that truth in the case of people in Moscow or in case of the Egyptians? No. But this is what it is. This is the reality we're looking at here. Okay. Unfortunately, there's so many excellent questions and excellent thoughts and excellent comments. Unfortunately, I do, in fact, have to go and take care of my children. So I will thank you all very, very much. This was, I feel, a very timely class in this moment in history. Thank you for being in it with me. And join me next week for the crescendo, the terrible, horrible, amazing crescendo. Thank you so much. And Maxine, I'm giving the mic back to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, really, thank you. It's been amazing to have a really close look at this. And, you know, of course, in the Seder, we always say that, you know, we're supposed to look at the story of the exile as if it happened to us personally. And I think, you know, you can, in terms of the way that people are thinking about this politically and what we're seeing in the world right now, I think that shows that everyone here is really doing that. And, you know, of course, thanks to the sources you've brought and you're guiding us through them. So thank you so much. And really, of course, hoping that things reach some sort of resolution soon. And hopefully our learning can be, you know, something to bring us there. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you, Maxine. Goodbye, everybody. May we hear good news.
Amen.